Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What movies are worth your time, and more importantly, your time off this holiday season? There is the Coen brothers' interpretation of the Charles Portis novel True Grit, Mark Wahlberg and Christian Bale as troubled boxer brothers in The Fighter, even Jim Carrey playing a gay con artist who meets the love of his life behind bars. So what do our favorite critics like? Christopher Kelly joins us from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Chris Wagner from the Dallas Morning News. Stephen Becker came all the way from his office downstairs with KERA's Art and Seek. Guys, welcome back to Think.
Thanks
for having us.
All right, I want to start not with any of those. I want to start with The Black Swan. This is a movie that people either seem to love or really just absolutely find everything to make fun of.
You put me in the love category.
Really?
Yeah, I thought it visualized what she was going through really well. And he's just a hell of a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's just got chops, and he's had them for years. And I think this is his most fully realized film thus far. It's, you don't see a ballet horror movie every day.
I was kind of in the middle category, which was, I thought it was so beautifully made. I mean, it's his most accomplished movie, Darren Aronofsky. But it really gets kind of ludicrous after a while. Natalie Portman's having visions and scratching at her skin, and it's bleeding, and it's a little bit, it's not for the squeamish, that's for sure. It's over the top, but it really is worth seeing, and it gets you talking.
Yeah, and I mean, not to blow your theory out of the water, but I was kind of with Chris in the middle category. Mm-hmm. In that I thought there was a lot to like about it. It was beautifully shot and pretty well conceived. I think I really liked, so there's this sort of parallel story of the Black Swan played among the director of the ballet and the two ballerinas. And all that I thought was nicely constructed, but there was just so much of this like horror movie schlock that kept pulling me out of the movie. Every time I would get engrossed in it, there'd be the fast music and, oh, get scared about this. And I just thought, there's so much going on in this movie about a story that's basically a story about a person going insane in pursuit of artistic perfection. Which is a really cool idea, and I felt like it didn't need those extra bits to it.
It's overstuffed in so many ways, because it's also an homage to All About Eve, to the red shoes. There's actual shots in the movie that are right out of Michael Powell's The Red Shoes. Barbara Hershey is kind of doing Piper Laurie and Carrie as the mother from hell. He really threw everything at this movie, and I think the fact that it doesn't lose control is really, it's all the ultimate testament to it. You're still with it at the end.
I think it's a great high wire act, because it doesn't do anything halfway, and it is over the top, but he's a disciplined enough filmmaker that he makes it work. There's no half measures in The Black Swan. It goes all the way, and I don't think it really works without the horror movie elements. I think there's a difference between horror movie elements and horror movie schlock. I think when it's done that well, it transcends schlock by a good measure.
And Winona Ryder is the rival dancer? Is
yes.
That right?
No. Winona Ryder is
a rival dancer.
Well, she's the dancer who's been retired.
Right.
And the rival dancer is played by Mila Kunis,
right,
who sort of is flirting with Natalie Portman, or maybe that's just in Natalie Portman's head. And they have this very strange sequence together, which is, I don't remember.
Well, and I will say that
some of the fellas might like it.
I did.
Yeah. I did think Winona Ryder was sort of perfectly cast in that role, because in a way it's kind of a wink, I think, of her current career, in that she was this really big time actress for a while there, maybe 10 years ago or so. And her, arc has been sort of on the downward spiral. And I kind of felt like she was playing into that in the movie,
yeah,
because she's just like all of the cliches of an actress who's a has-been in the movie, except she's a dancer. But I thought she really worked well.
And then she stabs herself in the face with the scissors multiple times. That's...
Spoiler alert.
Good times.
Yeah.
Good times.
And that, you know,
the scissors
the
are an interesting
movie
reference as well. If that actually happened in the film?
Yes.
Because you remember she was caught with scissors in her bag when she was shoplifting.
Chris Boyd, very sharp.
I read My People magazine when I'm done studying for this show. Okay, so I want to talk about True Grit here. The original film, made in 1969, won an Oscar for John Wayne. Chris Wagner, you don't think the original film was any good?
No, I mean, it's not horrible, but it's not really what made... I mean, John, it's a sentimental Oscar that John Wayne won. It's like Pacino winning for Scent of a Woman.
Mm-hmm.
John Wayne, no one's ever going to confuse for being a great actor. He's a great movie star. He was a great icon, and he was perfect for those classic Westerns. I mean, I don't, if I see Stagecoach or The Searchers or Liberty Valance on television, I'm going to keep watching it. It's just a very lazily made movie, in my opinion. Doesn't have a lot of vim to it.
The original, though, is interesting. I basically agree with that, but the original is interesting because it was really the last of those big Hollywood kind of G-rated Technicolor Westerns where it was, the good and the bad is very cleanly defined, and there's great moral lessons, and it's all shot against mountains in Arizona and Utah that look nowhere like the Midwest. And in a way, I think the remake almost is trying to get back to that kind of Western. The thing that people are going to be most surprised about coming from the Coen brothers is how straight this movie is. I mean, it's not... There's nothing glib. There's nothing jokey. It's a very elegant, very sort of old-fashioned Western.
Yeah, this is not a revisionist Western. It's not Deadwood. It's pretty classic.
And outside of it being really well-made technically, there's nothing about it. I mean, if you didn't know that it was made by the Coen brothers, there's no... That's the last people you would think had made this movie, you know? And I just found myself the whole time watching it thinking, all right, this is... well made and a good story and so on. But I was trying to figure out why they decided to make this movie. And I don't know if you guys know, but I've never been able to track the answer to that question down.
Well, they based it more on the novel than the movie. I think they really liked the book and decided they could do something with that. In fact, I don't think they even watched the film while they were making the movie. And it does have a really different tone. It's got sort of an Old Testament retribution feel to it that I don't think the original film quite gets at. And I also think it's a little bit easier to remake a movie that wasn't that good to begin with than to try to go back and monkey with the classic.
I think I agree with you, Stephen, but I liked it a lot more. I mean, I just enjoyed the craft of it. It's beautifully acted. Jeff Bridges in the John Wayne
part.
He's
great in it. He's
wonderful. Haley Steinfeld, who plays the Kim Darby part, the young girl who's on this journey for vengeance for her father's murder, is phenomenal. I mean, it's just out of nowhere performance. And I really found Matt Damon very charming in a role that Glenn Campbell famously was dreadful in the original. I agree with you. It's not very Coen Brothers-y other than it's just filmmakers working at the top of their craft across the board. The cinematography by Roger Deakins is beautiful. I think that's going to win the Oscar. The score by Carter Burwell. So I just enjoyed the experience of the movie. It was just so well done.
Yeah, I would say that Bridges is better in this than he was in Crazy Heart, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, and I'm with you. I enjoyed Matt Damon, and I've been thinking about him lately and how he's going to – I think he's going to make his own movie at some point as a director because he's, like, been putting himself through this film school through starring in movies by really good directors. I mean, he was in the Coen Brothers movie this time. You know, he's been in two Clint Eastwood movies. He's been in a slew of Soderbergh movies. He's really, like, I think – if I had to guess, I think he's picking out these people who he admires and going and playing whatever part that they kind of need him to play in an effort to, you know, tune up his film IQ. And anyway, I'll be really interested to see if he's the next Eastwood or a guy like that who decides to become a director more full time.
That's interesting because that's exactly what Ben Affleck did. He worked with directors he really liked until he felt he was ready to go out and do something. He's actually made a couple of really good films now.
Yeah, actually, I thought The Town, I thought it got kind of underrated. It did very well at the box office, but I didn't think the critics gave it the respect it deserved. I thought Ben Affleck did a great job directing
it. Yeah, too. It's a strong movie.
So now I'm going to go to what I'm assuming is not in the same category when we're talking remakes. There's the sequel to Tron. how did anybody think it was a good idea to reprise those roles?
Well, I mean, this is just all part of Hollywood trying to dig back to, you know, the studio executives' own youth. You know, they're all probably in their late 30s, early 40s at this point and trying to, you know, dig up the franchise, a new franchise that they can dust off and make $1 billion off of. Am I the only one who's seen this new one?
I believe so. I think you're exactly right in where you're going in that it was a prepackaged deal where I think that there was even – I think I read a story in the Times recently about how there already plans for a spinoff television series, and of course all of the
Bruce Boxleitner is probably available
merchandising and all that stuff. And someone must have come into the room and said, "Look, we got Jeff Bridges is going to be in again. We've got Daft Punk to do the soundtrack. Like, where could we go wrong?
Yeah, well, and they go horribly wrong by giving you a movie. I mean, I've described this as if you combine the incoherence of the third Matrix movie, the third Pirates of the Caribbean movie, and the last Airbender, you get to the realm of what the heck is going on in this in Tron. I mean, it's just minute to minute, they're just gibberish is coming out of their mouths. The plot makes no sense. They're in real world. They're in computer world. And I think it really speaks to how they make these franchise movies now, which is they just throw screenwriters on them and try to get it, you know, I guess, to a filmable level. I don't know how this script got made because it is just dreadful.
But it's pretty, though, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's marketed well, and people can wrap their head around the concept, and it'll be a big hit. So
let's talk about The Fighter. My first reaction, and it may be an amazing film, I haven't seen it, is does the world really need another boxing drama?
Of course not. The world doesn't need any movies, though.
I would add to that, does the world really need Christian Bale overacting again?
It's a great performance.
Yeah, I thought he was really strong in it. He's the one that you're going to come away thinking about. Although I will say, I think Mark Wahlberg deserves a lot of credit in this movie. He's not going to be the person you come away thinking about. And I think that's by design, mm-hmm. because his character in the movie is someone who his entire life has been dominated by his mother, by his brother, by this crazy gaggle of sisters that he's got. And so he's very passive in the movie, and he lets people kind of walk all over him. And so it's not a real showy performance. And, you know, there's talk that he might get nominated for it. I guess, did he get nominated for Golden Globe?
Yeah.
So, you know, he's getting some recognition for it, but it's not your typical, like, wow, he threw it all at the screen, and you can really see all of the acting with a capital A. It's really subtle, and I think you have to give somebody credit for letting other people fill in the script and the holes of the movie and sort of standing back and letting the movie come around you.
Steven, I'm with you on that. I agree Wahlberg's the best thing. And I want someone to explain to me, though, what's so good about Christian Bale and what's so good about Melissa Leo. These were the most scenery-chewing, overdone performances. Christian Bale twitching, crackheady shtick. Melissa Leo's got this accent, this crazy thick Boston accent. The hair's, you know,
wicked thick. I think.
Wicked thick, yeah. I just saw a bunch of Hollywood actors shticking it up, playing low class, overdoing it. I didn't believe a minute of it. The only thing I believed was Wahlberg.
See, I saw really big performances in a story that really warrants those performances, and I saw a filmmaker who knows how to use really big performances. I mean, this is a melodrama. It comes from a tradition of melodrama, and it's a boxing story, and it goes long. It doesn't, again, it's, I think I see a lot of similarities with Black Swan. It doesn't mm-hmm. do anything halfway. I don't think a big emotional performance is a bad performance, and I think the story is good for those performances, and I think the performances actually work out really well for the story. I thought Melissa Leo was fantastic, too. And I think Mark Wahlberg is really good at getting out of the way when he needs to get out of the way. And I don't mean that dismissively. I think that's a skill. He really subsumes his ego for the better cause of a film. And I've seen him do that before. I think that's pretty admirable quality for him. And he also produced the movie, so he knows what's best for it.
Boy, this has been a banner year for tough mothers between Barbara Hershey and the Black Swan and Melissa Leo in this movie. I think
It's also been a banner year, for the lack of a better term, for sort of dregs of society movies like Winter's Bone and you know, these sort of tales of the underclass that seem to be catching on. I don't know. I ultimately, to go back to what you said, Chris, I just felt like it was just another boxing story, and I didn't think it had sort of the majesty of Million Dollar Baby or the sort of underdog, you know, richness of Rocky.
I don't really think it's trying to have I hear the Rocky comparisons. I don't really think it's going for that. I think that's sort of a false comparison.
Chris Wagner, Christopher Kelly, and Steven Becker are with us. We're talking about movies for the holiday season this year. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
This is my younger brother.
You gotta help me finish this.
Taught him everything he knows.
You don't want to see where this fight is headed. Turn over.
I'm still his trainer. I have a fight next week. And after I win, I'm going to start making good money so you can live me more days, okay?
Good luck, Daddy.
Don't hold your breath, Casey.
Bye, baby.
You pave streets, right?
Yeah, I do. And I'm a fighter.
I heard you were a stepping stone.
Oh, I mean, I had a few tough fights, but the next fight's going to show who I am.
Yeah, and he's going to lose that one, too.
So move that sugar ass and give him a
hand. Don't disrespect her.
Mickey Ward is 31 years old. He's here because he needs the money.
Look at the size of that guy.
He's got 20 pounds on me, Dickie.
You don't fight, nobody gets paid.
Mr. Cogburn, in your 4 years as U.S. Marshal, how many men have you shot?
Shot or killed?
Let us restrict it to killed so that we may have a manageable figure.
Cogburn.
What do you want, girl?
I'm looking for the man who killed my father. The man's name is Tom Chaney, and I need somebody to go after him.
What's your name?
My name is Maddie Ross.
Are you some kind of law?
I'm a Texas Ranger. I know Chaney. It is at least a two-man job taking him alive.
Marshal Cogburn? Can we depart this afternoon?
Way.
I'm going with you.
I had the craziest dream last night about a girl who was turned into a swan. But her prince falls for the wrong girl and she kills herself. He promised to feature me more this season.
Well, he should. You've been there long enough. And you're the most dedicated dancer in the company.
Our new swan queen, the exquisite Nina Sayers.
I'm Lily. You're gonna be amazing.
Watch the way she moves. Sensual. She's not faking it.
Seduces! Attack it! Attack it! Come on!
Those were clips from this season's movies, The Fighter, True Grit, and Black Swan. And we are talking about movies with critics Stephen Becker, Chris Vogner, and Christopher Kelly. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. When I first heard I Love You, Philip Morris, I assumed that it was some kind of like thank you for smoking kind of thing. Nothing to do with cigarettes at all.
I think maybe a few people puff on a cigarette once in a while in the movie. But no, it's not about
But cigarettes. Honestly, if you told me, and I know you guys all sort of like the film, if you told me that Jim Carrey is playing a gay con artist who breaks out of jail, I would have thought a totally different sort of movie would have popped into my head.
Well, is a comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very funny movie.
One of the things that I love about it, he plays a gay con artist who ends up in prison, falls desperately in love with Ewan McGregor, and then keeps contriving ways to break out of prison so that he can be with him. And one of the things that's so charming and so weird and so clever about the movie is that it draws on Carrey's history. It's almost, I mean, he's this sort of antic, rubbery kind of guy. But there's also this real beating heart. There's this really passionate love story. And I called it like Brokeback Mountain meets The Mask. And this movie premiered last year, 2009 at Sundance. And it just sat on the shelf. No one knew what to do with it. It's a little graphic in parts, but it's finally getting out there. And I hope people go see it because it's really one of my very favorite movies of the year.
It also has elements of just being a fun, raunchy Hollywood comedy, which was what I wasn't quite ready for. I mean, I knew the main characters were gay, and I knew that was going to be part of the story, but the guys who made it wrote Bad Santa, and it has some of that kind of humor in it. And I think it's not revolutionary, but I think it's kind of groundbreaking to have a movie with gay main characters that actually adopts a fairly mainstream R-rated movie quality to it. That was one of the things that kind of surprised me and really pleased me about it.
And not a gay movie that is about martyrs, that is about, you know, these solemn
tales.
It's not
a symbolism kind of thing.
Yeah. This is not Milk.
Yeah, it's not Milk, you know.
Well, and I think, too, if you've only seen Jim Carrey and these sort of crazy comedy, you know, your Ace Ventura or Dumb and Dumber or something, in a way, I mean, his character is almost as crazy as some of those guys, but there's this underlevel sweetness to the whole thing. And he's doing all of these things for love, as you said. And it really is, I mean, it's, I think, one of the best love stories that was on screens this year.
That's funny. I mean, my favorite love story my favorite movie last decade was Eternal Sunshine. And that's Jim Carrey kind of minimizing the Jim Carrey shtick and doing a movie that has a lot of heart like this one.
I like when he minimizes the Jim Carrey shtick. I don't really like the over-the-top.
A little goes a long way.
Mania.
He kind of maximizes it here, but it works.
But to good effect. Yeah. And his character is supposed to be this over-the-top. Mm-hmm. You know, he just kills people with charm, and that it makes sense that his character would be sort of over-the-top like that.
We should also say it's based on a Texas story and a Texas man, Stephen Russell, and it's all based on true story.
Yeah, but I would like to add, though, if you aren't familiar with the story, don't go research it before you see the movie, because this is a movie I think that really holds its secrets very well, and there's a couple of like, oh my gosh, I didn't see that coming moments, and so you don't want to go ruin, if you don't already know the story, don't go research it first.
The very last twist is jaw-dropping, just great, great, great.
When people talk about potential Oscar films, The King's Speech always comes up. What did you guys think?
I think Stephen loved it, I liked it, and Chris didn't like it very much.
We have the rainbow effect.
I got to say, I mean, I do respect this movie. It's very well made. I'm getting bored just hearing myself talk about it. It's like another British monarch. Like, how do we have – how many more of these kings are out there that I have to endure these tales?
Helena Bonham Carter needs to eat.
Helena Bonham Carter plays the you know, the woman who's the current queen mother, and it's about Colin Firth, King George VI, and he has a stutter, and Geoffrey Rush has to help him. It's all very nice. It's all very elegant and nicely acted. I don't know what people are getting so excited about.
I thought it was the best thing I've seen this year.
Really?
And it was because it was a really interesting story, I thought, of two people working together on a problem. I mean, on its basis, you know, it's two people from very different walks of life. You have the King of England, or at parts of the movie, the future King of England, and this guy who is from Australia, who in British society at that point, you may as well have been, you know, from the streets practically, even though this guy, you know, really knew what he was talking about, played by Geoffrey Rush. And they are constantly doing this little dance of, we know we need to work on this problem, yet we have these social walls between us that are keeping us from truly connecting. You know, Geoffrey Rush wants to connect with the king, you know, the king played by Colin Firth, to really get to the root of the problem. As he tells him in the movie, people aren't born with stutters. They have something come around that makes them stutter. And I just felt like it was a really well-acted and well-told story of a period of history that, frankly, I didn't really know too much about that specific. Just when you think that there's not another movie that could be set against the backdrop of World War II, they find another one, and this is, you know, falls in that category. But I just thought it was really well made and really well acted.
I'm sort of in the middle. I mean, I thought it was a little bit staid and a little bit starchy, and yeah, don't always need to see another Brit drama about royalty. But also, I enjoyed the dance that Stephen was talking about between the two main characters, and I really like the way it plays off of our fascination with royalty. I mean, you have the commoner, and you have the king, and they're friends, but they can't really become good friends because there's this wall of propriety between them. So there's, it says a lot about, I think, private figures and public figures and how one can't always be the other. I thought it really played off of that, and I think it feeds, I think in America especially, we're obsessed with the royals. We always want to know exactly what they're doing. I think it's, as a story, it really humanizes that element, and it really sort of makes royal figures, I don't want to say bring them down to earth, but that relationship between royalty and commoner really worked well for me. And the acting is just fantastic. I mean, you got Derek Jacobi in this movie. You got Timothy Spall playing Winston Churchill, which is a lot of fun.
There's a lot of people.
Claire
Bloom.
Guy
Pierce. You got Michael Gambon. I mean, this is the Philadelphia Phillies pitching staff of casts here.
Well, I think some of that fascination comes from the fact that we can't imagine what it would be like to have a monarch But I think we also sort of convince ourselves in this country that there are no social divisions between classes. And in fact, there are. But because it's so artificial there, it seems fascinating.
I mean, I think what you guys are talking about is what I loved about The Queen, you know, and that movie was so acid and so so wry and sharp about these divisions and about how silly they are. And I just thought coming after The Queen, this just felt like such an afterthought to me.
I liked The Queen better.
Yeah, I think The Queen was probably a little bit better movie, or at least on par with it, which I should say really quickly, if you are unfamiliar with the story of The King's Speech, it's about the future King George the VI, I believe, who is about to become the King of England, but he has a really bad stuttering problem. And so he works with a therapist to help him get through that before he has to stand in front of a microphone, as we're doing right now, and speak to people all across the British Empire, all scattered around the world. So you can understand why that might be a little nerve-wracking for somebody who doesn't think that they can speak properly.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Mark in Dallas. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Thank you for a wonderful discussion about the movies coming up. This is really fantastic. What I was curious about is The Illusionist that's coming out, I believe, on Christmas, and it's a follow-up movie from the director of Triplets of Belleville, and I've been really looking forward to seeing this, and I was wondering what your thoughts are and if any of you have seen it and know anything else about the film.
Let's find out.
And the background.
Thanks for your call, Mark.
No, I'm really looking forward to seeing it, too. I haven't seen it yet. I love Triplets of Belleville, and I know it's based on a Jacques Tati story, and one of the things I really liked about Belleville is the way that it used his brand of humor, especially the visual timing, in an animated film. So I have not seen it, but I am really looking forward to seeing The Illusionist.
Yeah, same here. But the problem with, even for us professionals, it gets very crowded in December. So it's one of the movies on my list to get to.
Have they shown it yet? I don't know that they've shown it yet.
I don't think so, no. I don't think so.
Yeah,
not here.
One of us would have seen it, and I don't think we have, so that's probably why.
What about, have you guys seen Julie Taymor's The Tempest?
Yeah, I saw it. I liked it better than most critics seem to be liking it. It has a little bit too much CGI flash to it, and I don't always like her movies. I wasn't a big fan of Across the Universe, her Beatles movie, but I think the performances are great, and I like Shakespeare movies that really make the language accessible and make the situations accessible. And I think that's one thing she does really, really well. I thought she did it really well in her Titus as well. Helen Mirren is fantastic as Prospera, not Prospero. And I think they actually justify the changing of the gender of the main character really well. So I would say don't let most of the negative reviews keep you away, especially if you're a Shakespeare person and you like the play.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are y'all?
Great, thanks.
Great. Hey, y'all were talking about supporting actresses, I guess, Barbara Hershey, mothers in the movies this year. And some of them were fairly tragic. but one that we don't want to forget, I think, is Jackie Weaver's performance in Animal Kingdom, that Australian gangster film. I just thought it was absolutely brilliant, and her performance, I think, is just stunning.
Yeah, she's, for those who don't know about that movie, which is this sort of tale of dishonor among thieves in Australia, a family of crooks, and the young son who's trying to kind of go free, and she's this kind of Ma Barker type figure overseeing this brood of awful people, and she is just awful in the best sense of that term.
Yeah, it's a really good film. It's going to be in my top 10 probably. She has kind of a almost an older Betty Davis quality, really frightening and haggard, but completely confident and ready to do really bad things to somebody.
She was nominated for a Golden Globe, and I think you're going to see her name on Oscar nomination.
I hope so. I hope enough people have seen that movie, and I would urge people who haven't to go check it out. It's just a really, really strong crime movie with a really good family element, not in the Disney family sense, but about a family and the things that can go wrong in a criminal family.
Well, let's talk about family movies. I'm going to call it the third installment in the Meet the Parents series for fear of slipping up. You guys know the movie that I'm talking about.
It screens tonight, actually.
We're all a few hours away from seeing it. I know we're all, I'm sure, desperate with anticipation to see it.
Oh, he said Fokker. Oh.
Well, and it's, you know, obviously none of the three of us have seen it, but It's when you have franchises like that, what typically happens, and I want to be careful since, again, we haven't seen it, but a lot of times the first one's really good. You know, that
I really
like the
first movie.
I can see
the
appeal of the first one. The second one, it's like, not quite as good as the first. And then the third one, there's a reason a lot of times they don't have a fourth one. And so that's just my guess, but we'll see tonight.
I'm really fascinated by the comedy of embarrassment and why we flock to see people just sink so low and cringe. And I guess it's because we're glad it's not us that we're looking at up on the screen.
Because there's nothing worse than being embarrassed, which shouldn't be the worst emotion, but somehow it's just
You'd think
intolerable.
Ben Stiller would be over it by now.
No.
He's been embarrassed in pretty much every movie I've ever seen.
He's made a career of it at this point.
He's good at it.
I don't go to that many movies, but I've seen so many ads for the Reese Witherspoon, Paul Rudd, Jack Nicholson thing. How do you know?
Ooh, I don't
It's a stinker.
really?
Well, you know, I you could tell. How do you know this movie's bad? Owen Wilson's been cast as an Alex Rodriguez like baseball stud Lothario, and I'm just sitting there watching this, going, "Is James Brooks blind? Like, what? I mean, the most bizarre miscasting." This and The Tourist belong in a kind of double feature: Johnny Depp, Angelina Jolie movie, The Tourist.
Multiple Golden Globe nominees.
But both of these movies are just overproduced and have big stars not quite interacting with each other, and nothing quite works, and it all just sits there on the screen, and they're just dead on arrival. And I think both will face similar fates at the box office. This was a real disappointment.
I don't want to think that James Brooks has lost his touch, but it's starting to look like he's made so many great movies. I mean, Broadcast News, of course, Terms of Endearment. But it looks like he's kind of losing a little bit off his fastball.
One of the things
point.
About Broadcast News, particularly in terms of Endearment as well, is everything, all those emotions felt so real, and the worlds in which those people were interacting felt so real. And now you look at this movie and Spanglish, his last movie, and there isn't a second of it that rings true. It's so synthetic. It feels like they're movies made by a guy living in some giant mansion who never comes and engages with the real world.
And I think you hit it right on the head. Over the course of that 2 hours of the movie, I wasn't concerned at all about any of the characters' fates. They're all going to be fine. It's going to be fine, you know? And that, when you're not emotionally invested, even in a comedy or something that's supposed to be a comedy, it makes it a long slog through 2 hours.
Film writers Stephen Becker, Chris Wagner, and Christopher Kelly are my guests. We're talking about holiday movies for 2010, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
My husband is, he's required to speak publicly.
I have received.
Perhaps he should change jobs.
And what of my husband with a king? My husband has seen everyone.
Insert them into your mouth. Enunciate.
He hasn't seen me. I can cure your husband, but I need total trust. What was your earliest memory?
I'm not here to discuss personal matters.
Well, why are you here then?
Because I bloody well stammer!
This marks 24 hours of being stuck.
I've been chipping away. Want to keep warm than anything?
I have about 150 milliliters of water left, which should keep me alive till tomorrow night, if I'm lucky. So that's it. Mom, Dad, I haven't appreciated you as I know that I could. I love you guys, and I'll always be with you.
I'm Steven. I used to be a real stand-up guy. I was a good father, a good Christian, and a great husband.
And got to live in the American dream.
Then one day, something wonderful happened.
You might even call it
a revelation.
I'm gay!
You're what?
I'm gay.
Yeah.
Gay, 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 gay.
Those are some trailers. The first one from The King's Speech, then from 127 Hours, and then from I Love You, Philip Morris. We're talking this hour with our favorite film critics, Stephen Becker from KERA's Art and Seek, Chris Wagner of the Dallas Morning News, and Christopher Kelly from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here from Therese, who wants to know, what about Yogi Bear?
Hey, boo-boo.
TBA.
None of us have seen Yogi Bear, but there's this great YouTube clip going around which parodies the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, and it's called The Assassination of Yogi Bear by the Coward Boo Boo. And I recommend you YouTube it because it's delightful.
Somebody pointed out the other day that Justin Timberlake could be competing with himself if he gets nominated for both Social Network and Yogi
and
Bear.
Yogi Bear in the Best Supporting Actor category.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Boy, he's going to have an extra pair of smart glasses to wear when he goes on the awards tour with that. Then,
you guys have favorite films of the whole year?
I do. I'll go first. My number one is probably going to be 127 Hours.
I loved that. I went into it with trepidation, but I loved it.
Yeah, it's not. You know, we're talking about horror movies. It's not a horror movie. It's kind of, you know, the arm scene. I think everybody knows what happens there, and it's done pretty tastefully. And to me, it's just one of those great the world in a grain of sand kind of movies. And you have a guy stuck in a canyon for the better part of 90 minutes. And Danny Boyle just does so much to not just show what's going on inside his head, but also his environs. And I think about 10 years ago, Steven Soderbergh was the guy who was making great movies within the system that were getting awards, and he's still keeping his cred as an artist and a filmmaker. I think that's Danny Boyle now. I think he's really, he's been great for a while, but I think with Slumdog and now this, and with the kind of mass appeal he's getting, I think he's really starting to come into his own. And James Franco is fantastic as well. He's going to get nominated for Best Actor.
He is great in it. And I kind of thought that, in a weird way, 127 Hours, The King's Speech, and Black Swan are all kind of a piece in that they each have a lead character who has this really terrible internal turmoil going on with nobody on the screen really to talk to about it, you know? James Franco is literally by himself. Colin Firth can't talk, and Natalie Portman is just sort of so deranged that she doesn't have anybody that has her back anyway. But
well, she's a swan, too.
Well,
that makes it hard.
I guess, yeah. She has a beak. No, but the point is, though, it was interesting to see how the different filmmakers handled that. You know, we talked about how in Black Swan, how it was all visually done. Danny Boyle handled it with just all of the sort of kinetic energy that he kept throwing at the screen in a good way. And Colin Firth, I felt like you really saw all of his turmoil play across his face, much in the same way it did in A Single Man that he was in last, which I know some of you guys liked better than others. But anyway, it was a really interesting study of different ways that you can have characters express what's going on in their minds without saying it, I guess maybe is what I'm trying to say.
Is Firth why The King's Speech is your favorite movie?
Absolutely. Yeah, he's going to win. I think that he will win the Oscar. I think he deserves it. It's his time, and it's a showy role. I guarantee you when he looked at the script and saw, oh, wow, a guy that can't talk. What else? That's Oscar bait, but in a good way in this situation.
I think Eisenberg might win. Actually,
think so?
I think Jesse Eisenberg has a good shot at winning. If I had to pick a best male performance, I'd probably pick Jesse Eisenberg from The Social Network.
I guess of those three movies you were talking about, Stephen, I think the difference for me is that, and I did like The King's Speech. I felt those other two films you mentioned, Black Swan and 127 Hours, were very imaginative in the way they used the medium. And
sure.
I didn't really get that out of King's Speech as much, but that's obviously holding nothing against Firth. I thought he was fantastic as well.
Well, and I remember when we were talking about this, a few days ago, you were saying film is a visual medium, and I think you certainly have a point. I just felt like with Firth, you know, there was lots of really tight shots of his face, and I just really felt like you could read it all on his face, and I just thought it was really exceptional acting.
Yeah, he's excellent. He's fantastic in it, no question.
Chris Kelly, what's your favorite?
I'm going to take the snob route. And,
shocking.
I'm going to pick a six-hour French film called Carlos, which is Olivier Assayas's.
It's that Santana bio, right?
It's a three-part. It was originally made for French TV. Three-part French miniseries about the terrorist Carlos the Jackal. And the scope of this movie is so audacious. It goes to about 18 different countries. And takes you through this amazing history lesson in a white knuckle gripping, pure thriller old fashioned way, and the lead actor Edgar Ramirez, just magnificent performance. It has not actually opened.
I was going to ask you, is it going to open here?
And I don't know if it is.
And isn't there a truncated version? Or?
There's a shorter 2.5-hour version which has been getting out there, but if you can see the long version, it is. Really, I think, going to become a touchstone for world filmmaking.
I really want to see it.
It's a great filmmaker. I've seen it twice, actually, and the first time I saw it, I saw it over a couple of nights, and then the second time I saw it basically in one sitting with 20-minute breaks in between the two parts, and it plays great either way. I mean, it's so absorbing. I mean, you hear, oh, my God, a six-hour movie, and it's in many different languages, but it plays like The Bourne Identity. I mean, you just get swept up. It's so old-fashioned, and it's really, for me, it kind of far surpassed any other movie this year.
Sounds interesting to me. Jeff Whittington and I were talking about it yesterday, and it occurred to me the things that I might do with my life if I didn't have four kids.
A six-hour film is perhaps one of them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you gave 12 hours of your life to Carlos.
I do.
Impressive.
I'm a Carlos addict, and I want to do a runner-up plug for a movie that got kind of forgotten. From earlier this year, The Ghost Rider, Roman Polanski's movie, which I just thought was which is my number two. I thought it was just great and kind of seems to be forgotten in the awards derbies.
Yeah, I want to take another look at that.
And I have one more that I'd like to throw out that I don't think has been forgotten, but that we haven't touched on, which is The Kids Are All Right, which I really enjoy. That's the Annette Bening and Julianne Moore play a couple who are raising a pair of kids, and their kid's father comes back into the picture, played by Mark Ruffalo. It was excellent. It might be out on DVD by now.
I think it's just coming out this week.
It's probably right around now. Anyway, that one I think we'll keep hearing about all the way through March.
You know, I mean, it's in light of I Love You, Philip Morris, like how refreshing to see gay movies that aren't, you know, depressing, you know, people dying or being martyred or assassinated. And these are just about gay people living their lives. And the fact that they're gay is almost incidental to the actual movie.
Certainly in that movie.
So refreshing.
It's about time we got there, don't
you
think?
Yeah, it's so refreshing. And that movie particularly, it's so lived in. And Bening was terrific in that movie.
I actually think she's going to win.
That's a great
best
actress. This is not our Oscar show. Yeah.
We'll get there. No.
Come back later. Do you guys have movies that you watch? You watch so many movies. Are there things you like to watch over the holidays because they feel Christmassy or whatever?
It's funny. I mean, I never really considered It's a Wonderful Life a Christmas movie. And it has that Christmas element, and it certainly ends on Christmas. I always thought it was kind of more of an existential horror movie. but I love It's a Wonderful Life. I'm a big Bad Santa fan, and that might be partially because I'm not super reverent about Christmas. And for a movie to be that brazen about being irreverent towards
breaks
Christmas
every rule.
Really kind of tickles my heart.
My the one I always cite is Hannah and Her Sisters, Woody Allen's movie, which opens and closes at Thanksgiving celebrations. But it has this sort of wonderful autumnal holiday feel following these people's lives. And I just love that movie.
Well, I'll go not as highbrow. And there's a couple of comedies that I always like. Just the other night on TV, Christmas Vacation came on. Whenever Randy Quaid enters the scene, I mean, it's just he steals every scene he's in, which is great.
And steals other things, as it turns out.
I always get sucked into A Christmas Story when they play it for 24 hours on TBS or whatever it is. I've seen it a billion times, and I'll probably watch it for the billionth and first. And then I really like Elf. I know that kind of came and went, but Will Ferrell's really funny in it. I've been saying ginormous ever since I saw that movie. I think that was where that term was coined.
Do you know the four food groups?
Not off the top of my head. I probably should.
Candy, candy corn, candy canes, and syrup.
Syrup. Yes, I always forget syrup.
You do have four kids.
Right? Yeah, really.
Believe me. I always watch White Christmas every year. Mm-hmm. I love it. I love Bing Crosby, and I just think it's so much fun. And I remember watching that on, I guess, VHS when I was a kid. And that one and Meet Me in St. Louis.
I was just going to say, Meet Me in St. Louis is just fantastic. It's such a beautiful movie. Mm-hmm.
You have to fast forward through a couple of the slow songs, though. But the other stuff is good. I guess we have time to take one more call. Let's talk to John here in Fort Worth, who's been waiting very patiently. Hi, John.
Yeah, thanks. Have you guys seen the reviewers' Cairo Time? I think that's the name. And will Patricia Clarkson, I think the actress, that's her name, will she be nominated? Thank you.
I didn't see it. I'm a big Patricia Clarkson fan in general, but I missed Cairo Time.
I'll second that opinion.
Third.
Mark in Dallas wants to know, any good documentaries worth seeing right now?
God, this is such a great year for documentaries.
But it really seems like they all are lately.
This was a really good year. And it's a year for documentaries that will drive you crazy. I finally saw Waiting for Superman, which is Davis Guggenheim's portrait of the problems with the school system, last weekend. And I kid you not, was shouting at my television in frustration and anger at the sort of failures this movie exposes. And similarly, Inside Job, which was my pick for the best documentary of the year about the causes of the financial crisis. Just a fabulous, fabulous movie.
I think the teachers' union is waiting outside for you.
For Waiting for Superman.
The one that's the documentary, I like both of those movies a lot. And the one that I really liked and that really caught my imagination that's going to be in my top 10 is Exit Through the Gift Shop.
Oh, yeah.
Which is sort of a...
Banksy, is that right?
Yeah, it's made by a street artist named Banksy. He starts out being the subject of the movie, and then he becomes the director of the movie. It's sort of a through-the-looking-glass farce about the pop art world and instant celebrity, and it's one of the most mischievous films I saw all year. It came out earlier in the year, so it's not fresh in a lot of people's minds. I would highly recommend seeing Exit Through the Gift Shop if you haven't.
Yeah, I was just reading something today about if that ends up getting nominated, will Banksy actually show up at the Oscars to accept, since this is a guy who nobody really knows who he is. And it's interesting you mentioned that, because this is also kind of a year for documentaries where the lines are being blurred on docs, as far as with Exit Through the Gift Shop. There's a documentary called Catfish that came out earlier this year. And then the Joaquin Phoenix documentary about what is real and what's a story being inserted into the documentary. And I think that...
So I'm Still Here.
I'm Still Here, yeah. Anyway, I think what the takeaway is as you're watching documentaries that aren't something super straightforward, like Waiting for Superman, for example, it's time that you got to be a little bit... You have to watch it with a little bit of a skeptical eye and not just say, oh, this is a documentary. Everything on the screen must be true. It's still important to watch movies and say, I wonder if that's really what's going on here.
I'm afraid to ask. Did you guys like Babies?
I haven't seen Babies.
I like Babies in general, but I have not seen the movie.
It looked a little cloying, I got to say.
You know, we watched it with our kids, and we don't watch every movie with our kids, but it was really interesting because you start to recognize how different our existence is in the West and in a wealthy country. And actually, the San Francisco baby and the Tokyo baby lead pretty similar lives. And then they have one who's in somewhere in Africa and then somewhere in, like, Outer Mongolia. And it was pretty interesting culturally. There's no dialogue in the whole thing, and I was surprised that it kept my attention, but it was good.
Was the San Francisco baby going to raves and hanging out at North Beach and sipping espresso?
Maybe that'll happen in the sequel.
The other doc I wanted to mention was the Joan Rivers documentary, which I thought was one of the most insightful movies about show business, about what it takes to survive.
Kidding.
It's not just Joan Rivers shticking it up for 80 minutes. It's a really insightful movie.
We'll have to leave it. Yeah. We are totally out of time. We've had Christopher Kelly, Stephen Becker, and Chris Wagner. Guys, thanks. It's always great to have you.
Thanks, Chris.
Anytime. Thanks for having us.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.